Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi there, I'm Joel Meyer. I'm a radio producer. That means I work behind the scenes. Normally, I don't get to do this, the talking, at the start of the show. My job is normally to get people to come to the studio for a conversation. The more interesting, talented, and famous they are, the better. But I'm going to tell you a secret. Interesting, talented, and famous people get bored. Musicians get tired of talking about a new album they finished making a year ago. Athletes give the same post-game interview over and over again. But get that athlete talking about the guitar he just bought, or ask that musician about her favorite baseball team and its chances in the postseason? Very different conversation, but one that almost always happens when the mics are off. Well, that's the conversation we're going to have on this show. With the mics on, we call it...
Players on Players.
Okay, that was half the show budget right there. But do you get it? Players on Players? A player can be a football player, like former Baltimore Ravens defensive back Dominique Foxworth.
And there he goes! Foxworth hands it off to Ray Lewis, and we have our first turnover of the game. That's a 23-yard return, and the Ravens got it popping on defense already. Well, that is a great play by Foxworth.
These days, Dominique is the president of the Players Association. That's the NFL Players Union. He led the negotiations with team owners during that big lockout in 2011.
We definitely made some adjustments to the way the financial system works and to a way that we're comfortable with and the owners get some benefit out of also.
And a player can also be a guitar player, like the independent singer-songwriter Aaron McKeown. We're going to find out what Aaron has to say about sports and whether Dominique even likes music. And we're going to let them ask the questions. I'm going to stay out of the way. By the way, this is the first time that they've met, and you should know that they can't see each other because they're sitting in radio studios in different cities. Here's how they started this edition of Players on Players.
Much like you, Aaron, I'm in a box. It feels like, it reminds me of those kind of movie interrogation rooms, because there are these, I'm in this little room, and there's two big windows with two guys staring at me. And I'm not gonna give them anything, because I plan on being free after this is all said and done.
This is like Law and Order Public Radio.
It feels like it. It definitely does. And I know that you've done one of these already, and I was a little intimidated, and hearing your voice, you have a good radio voice, I'm a little intimidated, but being the competitor that I am, I assure you that I'm going to win today's conversation. I will have better questions and better answers than you, I guarantee it. Yeah, I'm going to try to win, and don't you pretend like you're not trying to and try to steal my joy
from
winning.
See, now you know.
You're going to say,
works.
just go ahead, don't worry about it, I don't care. No, you care.
No, it's true. I do care, but it reminds me, I'm curious, so you sure... a film producer now, right? What skill set could what skill set are you bringing that's maybe from being an athlete or maybe from other things you've done that you think are going to make you a good film producer?
Money. that is what the film that I, it's my first and could potentially be my only film that I'll be involved in. It's just about the exploitation of college athletes and just kind of the perversion of the collegiate athletic system. And so I bring a lot of connections in the sports world and been able to set up some great interviews for our filmmakers with some top level talent in the NFL and NBA, and also help to finance the project. So
you are retired from the NFL. You're about to go to Harvard Business School, which, by the way, congratulations. That's amazing.
Thank you.
You're about to do that this fall. Are you still going to say when someone says, "Who are you?" is the first thing you say, "I'm an athlete"?
Yeah, I always hated when people ask me what I did for a living. When I first met my wife's parents, I told them I was a writer, because my first year in the NFL, I wrote a weekly column for the Denver Post about my rookie experience. So whenever I met people, I would tell them that I was a writer when obviously I was a football player, just because there are so many stereotypes and perceptions that people have about you based on being an athlete, and I didn't feel like fighting against those all the time. I just felt like I wanted them to accept me, and then maybe later on I'd say, well, I write sometimes, but I'm actually a football player, after you already know who I am. So I think that's what made this transition for me so smooth, is I don't feel that major loss of a part of me. I'm competitive, and I think going to Harvard Business School will feed that. So I think
you're going to find some competitive people there.
Yeah, I won't have a loss there, and I'll still have that drive. So I have a ton of questions about just the artistic process, and it seems like listening to your songs that you genuinely put yourself in your music, and it's not so much that you're trying to project an image as you are just kind of telling it how it is and telling emotions and feelings that you genuinely have. So I would assume that you are comfortable with saying that you're an artist and comfortable with having people judge you to some degree by the work that you produce. Am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong at all. I mean, it is interesting because I've been in the music industry for a long time, and I don't know how much you are a music fan or how much music is a part of your life, or and, you know, then the next part will be how much you would even pay attention to the music business too much. But you must know that it's changed a lot in the last 10 years, even longer than that. And my career has interestingly spanned that change. You know, I my first record came out when I was in college, a junior in college in 2000. And, you know, here we are in 2013. And in the meantime, I have signed with record labels, been independent, you know, worked with big companies. Now I've got my own company. I'm on my own label. But there was a time in my career where I was trying to participate more in a mainstream music industry, and maybe a little bit the way I looked, and certainly the way I was writing, and I didn't do it very well, honestly. And I'm pleased that I didn't do it very well, because I think sometimes artists can have a certain kind of success, and then it ends up limiting them. And so I'm grateful for the kind of unlimited feeling that I have right now. But at this point in my career, yeah, I basically like do what I want, say what I want, look how I want, and feel very, very free in that. But, you know, talking about the stereotypes, I was thinking about this as you were talking, which is that, you know, I carry around a guitar all the time. I basically never travel without one. And I have had so many experiences in the elevator at the hotel at like midnight. Like, I'm coming back from a gig, I'm so tired, I just want to go to bed. And someone sees the guitar and they're like, oh, what kind of music do you make? And I don't always know how to answer that question. And the stereotype that dogs me the most is if I say, I'm a songwriter. People look at me as a woman who's small and who has a big guitar, which maybe they can't see because it's in a case, and they think that I am a folkie. They think that I play like finger-picked acoustic guitar, you know, and sing in a soft voice. And you know, you've had a little bit of experience with my music, but you know that that's not true for me. So I actually go this like other route where I'm like very specific. I'm like, I play electric guitar. It's very rock. And, you know, sometimes I mess with people and say I play Christian music. But but for the most part, like, I feel like I have to fight the stereotype of what a small woman does as a songwriter.
Break my back and tie my hands. Send me to the jailer. For every man that jailer keeps, his soul is getting darker. Try to cross him if you can, scar across the desert.
I wonder, I know one of the toughest things, or one of the more important things about playing well was getting in the right frame of mind. And we only had 16 games and maybe some playoffs. So, and you had to do it once a week, and it still wasn't very easy to get in the right frame of mind. And it sounds like all you do is like play shows all the time. How difficult is it to And what do you do to get yourself in the right frame of mind to put on a good show? Or are you not always in that frame of mind?
I didn't think about that till you just said that. But of course, like you had 16 games a year. And I mean, as a fan, that's what makes the NFL like so excellent for us, is because like it's just so important. Each game is so important. And we play all the time. I play all the time. And when you do something all the time like that, you certainly get into a rhythm of it. If I have, you know, my ultimate preference is to play 3 days on, have 1 day off. That's my thing. You know, after 4 shows in a row or 5 shows in a row, your body starts to really feel bad, and you start to lose the connection with the music. Now I have done as many as 16 shows in a row. You're crazy, 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 crazy. So it's like, so you play 16 games over 17 weeks and I play 16 shows in 16 days. But, you know, the more I do it, the easier it is to just stay in the mindset. And for me, preparing for a show, I actually like to think about, I don't want to think about the show at all until the moment I step on stage. I actually will want to do anything but think about that show until I go play it. Now I have to do a few things. You know, I warm up my voice a little bit. I warm up my hands. I do some stretching, make sure I have a cup of tea. I do a couple things for my body. But mentally, I actually don't want to think about that show until the very moment I play it. And I would imagine that is the total opposite of preparing for an NFL game.
I mean, it was for me. I think it's we spend all week preparing for the game. All day, all week preparing for the game. So once you get on game day, it's not much you can do. So it's not that different in that you're not building the game plan the morning of the game. And everyone has a different routine. I always liked to take notes throughout the week and reference them. And then right before the game, I would review my notes and just kind of get in the right frame of mind hours before the game. Then when it got close to the game, that's when I guess our conversation would get interesting. But that's when music came into it, because that's the one thing throughout the course of my life, I think, that my interest and appreciation for music has changed. But the one thing that has never changed, has always been important, is the emotion that music evokes in me.
I'm really interested for you in this, like, I have this image when I think of athletes preparing for a game or like walking into the stadium on ESPN, they always have headphones on. And sometimes I think that there's nothing on in those headphones. Those headphones just mean don't talk to me. But I'm curious, like, be specific. Like, what did you listen to? Like, to get your emotions going, to get you ready for this game.
It's funny how I said earlier that I didn't like people to assume things about me based on stereotypes of athletes or even stereotypes of black males. But you would be very safe in trying to figure out what I listened to before a game if you jumped on stereotypes of black men. So it's all hip-hop.
I could try. Do you want me to try?
Sure.
Let's okay.
Go down a list of songs that, or songs or artists.
Well, artists. All right. So I'm going to guess there's like no Usher.
And I'm, of course not.
Yeah. No. And then I'm going to guess that not. There's probably like Jay-Z, T.I., Lil Wayne. That might be the
one. Yeah, I mean, you're right so far.
Okay,
how else do you get riled up to run headfirst into another man without listening to these crazy rappers?
I wouldn't know. So.
Yeah, you were, but if you were about to go into a fight, would you turn on Usher?
No, of course not. No, Usher would be like, Usher would be, for me, Usher is like bedroom music or something. It's like,
absolutely, for everyone.
Yeah.
Going we've reached the climax. We're together, now we're undone.
Do you, what type of music do you listen to?
I don't listen to music. That's the secret. And I don't
That's
think,
fantastic.
I don't think it's that rare for professional musicians or writers to say that. Actually, I felt bad about it for a long time, and then I paid attention. Some other artists said the same thing. You know, I have so much music in my head all the time that sometimes I just need a break. And you know what I listen to all day, honestly? Like when I'm like at home and I got to do work, sports talk radio. Like it's just on, and I live in Massachusetts, so and I listen online, so I could theoretically listen to any sports talk radio, but I do listen to Boston sports talk radio,
well,
which is ridiculous.
we are like twins, because sports talk radio, I would rather slam my head into a wall for an hour than listen to sports talk radio. It's just they have no idea what they're talking about, and
I would
just
imagine
it's dreadful. But I think that I understand. I don't I get enough football. I've had enough football through the course of my life. It's like work, and I assume that you feel the same way about the business of music as I do about the business of football and the business of sports in general. Like, I've been so close to the business of football that I'm jaded, and I don't see it the same way that you see it, I would assume, where it's, like, fun and great. I've had face-to-face contentious negotiations with owners about player health and safety when all they care about is increasing the bottom line. So it's tough for me to watch a game and see guys slamming into each other, and I understand the amount of wear and tear it's going to take on them and the price that they're going to pay in the course of their life. And I also understand that the owners don't care. They want to move that guy out as soon as he's no longer valuable and move another player in, which I would assume that is very similar to the music industry, and the big labels just are trying to churn out these kind of copycat artists to keep raking in the big bucks. So
It's exactly the same. No, it's exactly the same. And in the music business, there's an underground world where we're not subjected to some of those same pressures. But at the same time, I mean, I certainly know enough about the music business and in general corporate culture, because that's really what we're talking about. Like, whether it's a big record label or, you know, a billion-dollar sports franchise, like, we're talking about a corporate culture, and I think there are plenty of similarities in how people run that stuff. So I certainly know that sports is a corporate culture, and you know, when Kevin Ware got hurt, for example, you know, right away, I'm listening to writers or looking at writers who are talking for real, like, what's going to happen to him, and bringing up the conversation of NCAA athletes and stuff like that. But, you know, I guess for me, sports, because even though I understand those things and certainly from a political side really care about business and its effect on people, because I'm not an athlete, I still get that one layer of distance that allows me to enjoy sports in a particular way. But that's not to say that I don't care an awful lot about the business of sports and doing it the right way, which is why I'm so fascinated and was so excited when your name was proposed, because I certainly knew who you were as the president of the NFL Players Association. It was really great, especially during the lockout, to get to sort of watch you do what you were doing. What does that mean to be the president?
Yeah, it means a lot of responsibility, and it means that a lot of people hate you. It's funny because even on the player side, no one calls and says, hey, you did a great job. Thanks for expanding our benefits or increasing salaries or protecting our health and safety. People only call when when things aren't going well. So it's a bit stressful in that way, but it felt like a calling. I felt like I needed to step up and take on this challenge during a very kind of tumultuous time in our league's history, and I'm proud of what I've accomplished. So it really felt good.
Did it enrich your on-field experience? Like, while you've been the president, I know you were injured and were not playing games regularly. But right. So no, why not?
I think that's something you step behind the curtain. While I think all players are very familiar with the business of football and how expendable they are in the eyes of the organization, it's different when you sit in the room and watch these or argue with the owners about the bottom line and expenses, and you just see it's very ugly in corporate. It's not like high school where you go to class with these guys and you love your team and everybody's a team. No one's going to get traded or cut or anything like that. It's you just kind of lose a little bit of the innocence of the game is lost. Not that there's a whole bunch left once you get to the professionals, but whatever is left, it is definitely lost. And I guess I was wanted to ask you about, since you're kind of everything in your own career as far as business and artist and performer and manager, just do you find yourself ever putting on that corporate hat where when you're making a song you try to think about what you could add to the song that would make it more popular, or is it just 100% you allow yourself to be artists and you put out what you feel, and if people like it, they like it, if they don't, they don't?
Well, I think that, like I said, there was other times in my career where I might have, when I was actually writing a song, be thinking about something like that, and I was at a certain point in my career, I had signed to a label and had turned in a version of a record. And about 3 weeks later, they sort of like sent it back. And they said it was too short. They said it wasn't enough songs or enough time to be priced as a full-length album, which I thought was interesting that they were thinking about price and value versus like what the songs sounded like, you know, quantity versus like the quality of it. And then they said, so since we need you to make it longer, and they actually gave me a time period, they said it needs to be a 40-minute long record in order for us to price it full price. Could you also write a couple more songs, and could you think about the radio? And I had, that's sort of like every musician's nightmare, right? Yeah. That you're like, you can sign with this label and then they're going to tell you what to do. And they were Canadian, so they were very nice about it. but they really wanted me to think about that. And I, you know, freaked out. What am I going to do? What am I going to do? And I called a bunch of other artists, and they all had more practical things of like, look, if you have to write a song on a deadline, here's four things that you do and guarantee you'll get a song out of it. And those four things are really fascinating and fabulous. And as any type of creative person, they're all helpful. But then on the other hand, like the pressure of that, I actually wrote like what is probably one of my most famous songs. And according to some people, like some of my best songs.
Not according to you, though.
No, not necessarily. I mean, I'm proudest of some of the songs on the newest record. There's something about them as, and this speaks to your question, that is authentic in this particular way that I've been trying to get at for a long time in art. But, you know, you're right, like, especially right now, because I run my own label and raised all the money for this record myself. And, you know, I have an agent, but I don't have a manager currently. And I did have one for a long time, so I understand that job. But there are certainly times where, you know, I knew that if I put a song on my record that I wrote with Rachel Maddow, I knew that that was going to be really good for my record. And I knew that that was going to get me some attention that I wouldn't be able to get on my own. And I think the song is good, and I'm not speaking out of school. I mean, I think Rachel knows this too, but it's like, it's not my best song, and it's not her best song. You know what I mean? But like, we put it on the record because of those concerns. And I think there's a line, you know, valid concerns of like, you want people to, I want people who don't know about me to find out about me. And there's a certain amount of things you have to do.
But I don't know that I've heard any of her music.
She's never written a song before. it was a project that we did as a benefit for another organization. But I'm curious. Like, you know, you identify yourself as a writer. I'm curious. Like, have you ever picked up an instrument?
I've picked up an instrument. I wasn't any good at it. I played a saxophone way back in the day when I was like elementary and middle school, and I was terrible. But I definitely went through a phase where I was like writing hip hop lyrics, which I never actually performed them because I didn't think of myself as a rapper. But I remember where I felt like the music that I liked was deteriorating, the value was going down. And one of my friends, I was just like, man, I could write this crap. So I started writing it and started writing this crap. And I thought my crap was better than their crap. But I'm me, so I guess I'm a little biased. And I think my friend went on to pursue a career that didn't really turn into much. But I never really took it very seriously. It was just like I was wondering if I could do it. And I felt like I could. It didn't seem that hard, but I never really had the validation of having anything heard or read or listened to.
Can you remember any of your rhymes? No?
Mm-mm. Of course not. No, absolutely not. I was like 12 or 13, and I can't remember back that far. And if I could, I would say that I couldn't.
Because I would love to know what like the 12 or 13 year old Dominique was like thinking was worthy of lyrics, you know.
I thought I was deep, so that was what frustrated me most about the music that I thought was starting to just hip hop culture in general. I felt like was a very organic thing and natural, and then the corporate world got their hands on it and try to reproduce it and pump it out and kind of formulaically in order to maximize profits. And from that, I got annoyed and I kind of went away from music, and which now today I don't dislike music. I listen to music for the emotion that it evokes, and I don't necessarily listen to music or scrutinize music in the way that I did when I was younger. Probably partially because I don't have the time to. When you're a kid, it's like, what else are you going to do? But and partially now just because I've just been turned off by the commercialization of and just monetization of what I think started as a real, genuine, natural, honest expression of talent and emotion.
Well, let me ask you this. Can you name me, because I could think of some artists who sort of fall on the like pre-corporate side in hip hop, but can you name me artists you were listening to that you feel like exemplify like now what's lost?
Well, I think some of them have kind of followed the crossover. So, I mean, I think Jay-Z is probably my favorite of all time just because he's been able to manage that. I mean, his music is very commercial, but if you listen to his songs, there's songs of his that I've listened to for years, and I still pick up something new, like a new kind of wordplay that I didn't hear in the past, or an allusion to some historical event that I wasn't aware of before. And
like
now
what?
That
Can
I'm old enough,
name me
I understand
a song.
It.
Name me a song.
Jeez, they're all really great. actually, there's a song. It's not an actual song on an album, but there's a song, a freestyle that he did that is you could probably find on the internet called Grammy Family. He did it on a New York radio station. It's a song that I really like. There's just some really cool lines in it.
That's only half if they like you. They ain't even the half what they might do. Don't believe me, ask Michael. See Martin, see Malcolm. You see Biggie, see Pac, see success in its outcome. See Jesus, see Judas. See Caesar, see Brutus. See success is like suicide. Suicide is a suicide.
It's just about the difficulties with rising to success. And I know there's a line. It came out around the time when Bobby Brown had a reality show, and there was a line that said to be Bobby then, meaning when Bobby Brown was really popular, you have to be Bobby now. And the name of the TV show was like Being Bobby Brown. So it was like a play on the name of the TV show and pointing out that there are drawbacks from the celebrity.
They remind you ghetto. So it's tough being Bobby Brown. To be Bobby then, you got to be Bobby now. Now the question.
And I think there was another line where in there about something about being king. You could be found on the balcony with holes in your dream.
Yeah, everybody want to be the king. The shots ring, you're laying in the balcony with holes in your dream. Or you're Malcolm X.
Just about Dr. King, being king. And obviously Dr. King was murdered on the balcony of the Lorraine Hotel. And the I Have a Dream speech is like, I'm messing it up, but I'm sure if you are that interested, and if anyone who's listening is that interested, you could look up the lyrics. There's a website called Genius Rap Lyrics.
Yeah, I
love.
I know that website.
Oh, yeah, I love that. More than listening to music, I like going to that site because it explains all the lyrics. And there's that song, Grammy Family, in itself, throughout there's all these great allusions and that's what I love most about Jay-Z is it seems like the art that he puts in his music, he doesn't care if you get it or not. So like he sprinkles his music with kind of commercial garbage that I think he would recognize as commercial garbage, and it sells like hotcakes. And then if you actually listen to it, if you care to put some effort in, you'll come out thinking, wow, that was really something. So I don't know that I would put him in a category as the pre-commercial. I think he's the guy who's perfectly blended the two. But I really love Nas, and Lupe Fiasco, I think, is not very commercial these days. And Common, who's gotten more commercial, he's always someone who I've respected. But what about you? You said that it was a part of your life. What artists, hip-hop or not, have either resisted the commercialization or assimilated without losing their artistic influence?
I don't know that I would have like quite the length of like love. For example, in hip hop, like I don't have quite the length or depth of knowledge to be able to say more than like what you said about Jay-Z. I agree with. But you know, there's other. I mean, I think there's other artists that I've listened to. This is gonna sound really silly, but because I grew up in Virginia. There was this like local dude who played all the time in the bars named Dave Matthews. And he was like the favorite.
I've heard of him.
Yeah, right. He was the favorite of my camp counselors. And so I would be 12 or 13 years old and they would hand me a cassette tape and be like, this was Dave's latest show last week at the bar. And I would pick that tape apart. And I learned to play guitar listening to that. And I learned to think about lyrics listening to his lyrics. And then I have this intimate knowledge of the early part of his career, and, you know, I hardly listen to him at all or pay attention to it now. But I did watch, for example, like, I think his music got less interesting as, like, the commercial stuff started to come in for him. But I'm curious, and I'll give you some of mine in a moment, but, like, I'm curious for you, like, what are there athletes that you look at, you know, now and have respect for how they've, you know, navigated the system, which you also know so well.
Just throughout history, there have been a ton of the athletes that have just used their platform in an impressive way. And no matter what's happened in the game or what's happened around them, they've maintained a very high level of integrity. And I think the civil rights movement in general is one that I look to. Just Tommy Smith and John Carlos in the 68 Olympics taking that stand and having their medals taken and being sent home for drawing attention to the injustices in the United States, and Bill Russell and Jim Brown. The list goes on of guys that I look at, and they've made decisions that were not in their best interest, but were in the best interest of the country. It's something that I admire. And I think today, I think a lot of athletes take on issues, none of the size of that those guys took on, but they take on their own issues and have significant platforms that they try to move the ball on, whether it's childhood education or hunger or obesity. There's a number of guys that I've had experience with that are willing to step out there. And I think with the gay rights issue, it's something that I've been outspoken on, and a lot of our players have been outspoken on, that it makes me really proud to see guys take that stand. I think there's in general, people, especially with football players, our country kind of looks at football players as the epitome of masculinity and think that what we do on the field is true masculinity. Whereas I think the stands that some of us take off the field is just an image of masculinity that doesn't always get shown. Being unafraid to slam your head into someone else is, I guess it's a version of bravery, or maybe you would say that it's stupidity, but maybe it's a version of bravery. But standing up for an oppressed minority, in this case homosexuals, is brave also, and that's extremely masculine. So I've just been proud to see that transition and athletes in the NFL and NBA. I know Kobe and LeBron came out in support of Jason Collins, and Jason Collins came out in support of Jason Collins. And lots of players in the NFL have, including me, have been writing and speaking on legalization of gay marriage and the acceptance of homosexuals in sport. So yeah. What about you? How do you feel about athletes in the same way that we talked about musicians?
Well, I definitely am glad you brought up masculinity. But, you know, growing up, not being as aware of those kind of issues, my favorite players were, you know, especially like growing up in a pre-internet world, like, you know, I grew up an Orioles fan and a Redskins fan. So, you know, I loved Art Monk and I loved Charles Mann and I loved Doug Williams so much and vaguely was aware and understood of what it meant for him to be the successful black quarterback at that time. I also loved Cal Ripken. He was probably my most favorite athlete growing up. And I'm still sort of waiting for the other shoe to drop about Cal Ripken. I'm still waiting to like find out that he was actually like a terrible person or something. But he, for me growing up, he was the epitome of a athlete with integrity that I really admired. But now, yeah, thinking about now, the athletes I admire most are exactly what you're saying, are the ones who challenge and bring to the forefront, whether explicitly or not, like this idea of masculinity and what it is. So I, you know, that some in some ways that has to do with like gay rights, but in other ways I also want to keep it separate because they don't have to be the same thing. But, you know, so I do like these players, especially, you know, you mentioned some NFL players that have done a really great job in the last couple of years of like standing up for stuff. And I also I would bring up R.A. Dickey, the Mets knuckleballer, right, who's now with the Blue Jays. But he I thought it was an amazing thing for him to come forward about his experience with sexual abuse and to talk about it and to write. He's written a really great book about, you know, how he became a better knuckleballer and how that was a good metaphor for his life and about his journey in becoming more truthful with himself. And I know there's other athletes who have come out about their experience with sexual abuse. And, you know, I think that also challenges this idea of like of what it is to be a quote unquote real man. But I also want to make sure, like, when we talk about these athletes, you know, currently, there's also plenty of women athletes for me that have been really important. As a kid growing up, I swam and played field hockey pretty extensively and was also a tennis player. And so I certainly paid attention to what kind of person Steffi Graf was, and I certainly admired Billie Jean King and Martina Navratilova. I don't think I was even aware, like, that Martina Navratilova came out. She just was, like, Martina to me. Right. And that was always just part of who she was. And today, you know, female athletes that I admire, I mean, certainly Brittany Griner comes to the top of the list for me, even before her taking on issue of sexuality.
All right, you guys, so I'm going to jump in. We just have basically a little bit, about a minute or so. I just thought that was really, really great.
I told you that yesterday, Joel.
Yeah, I know, and I didn't listen. And
so, Joel, who won?
Yeah.
I'm going to call this, because you're a soccer fan, I'm going to call this a tie.
Nicely done, Joel.
Dominique, it's been so great to talk to you. And if it's okay, I'm going to ask Joel to pass my email address on to you.
Yeah.
I would love to stay in touch.
I didn't know if I could do that. It was going to be weird.
No, I would love to stay in touch.
That's what I'm here for. I do all the weird work.
Thank you so much.
This was awesome. Right, thank you, Dominique.
Bye-bye.
Players on Players is a production of WNYC New York Public Radio. Our team includes Jacob Kramer-Duffield and Rebecca Lehrer, with Chris Bannon overseeing the whole shebang. Special thanks to Stephen Dubner of Freakonomics Radio for his help with this show. And also, we want your help with this show. We want to know what you think. What do you like? What don't you like? And maybe which musicians and athletes do you want to hear on the show in the future? You can contact us through our site at playersonplayers.org. I'm your producer, Joel Meyer. Thanks for listening.